Okay, well, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm the host of City Visions, and we're joined by Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who represents the East Bay here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Congressmember Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
So I wanted to ask you what's in the news right now. We keep hearing about the stimulus package that negotiators are trying to resolve with Mitch McConnell, and we're hearing that there's a holdup. Can you tell us what the status is of the recovery stimulus package for COVID relief?
Sure. As you know, people are living on the edge right now in terms of their lives and their livelihood. So we're trying to come up with a package that would last, that would be, cover probably 3 months until we, of course, have a new administration who will actually provide support for a real stimulus package. I'm calling this a supplemental. But what we're trying to do is make sure that people have additional unemployment compensation, the $600 a week that they deserve because of this pandemic. As I understand it right now, the Republicans would only go for $300 a week. There are some key provisions around testing, tracing, and treatment that we're working on as it relates to the healthcare provisions. And of course, we're... I believe some of the tough points of negotiation right now that they don't want to address would be the whole issue around liability, where if people go to work and catch and get the virus, then they can be exempt from any liability for that. That's a big issue because essential workers deserve to be protected. If they go to work, they're essential workers. And so we need to be sure they have the protections that they deserve, and also state and local governments. We have to remember that we need to fund state and local government. I believe the package was negotiated at about $160 billion, which is a drop in the bucket, but it's something, and that would help prevent layoffs in some states. But this is an important provision because essential workers are hired by state and local governments. And they should not have to be laid off because they, first of all, deserve their jobs and to be able to keep working through this period. But also they're providing the essential services that are needed during a pandemic.
And that liability shield that you mentioned that Republicans are trying to get into the a bill, is that an absolute non-starter for Democrats?
Well, we're trying to make sure that it doesn't get in the bill. You know, that it's having immunity for against companies or organizations that hire people and they do not protect people is to me a very serious stickler in this. And so it's one of the issues that we're trying to resolve with the Republicans. Again, there are several issues, but this is a big issue that is so important for the protection of employees and workers.
And so what's your prediction about what you think is going to happen with these negotiations?
We're trying to move as quickly as possible. It's up to really Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump and the Republicans. I know Speaker Pelosi is negotiating day and night. And so we're trying to also make sure we keep the government open. We have a drop dead deadline for that, December the 18th. And so I would say, you know, we're working as quickly as we can. We hope it's as soon as possible. And as we want it to be as soon as possible because people need this assistance. They need the PPE. People, small businesses need their the resources to help them stay in business. And people need their money. I mean, I want to see direct assistance in this bill. Right now, I don't believe that's in it. You know, the $1,200 cash direct assistance payment and $500 for each child. That I understand the Republicans do not want to put into the bill. That's sort of a non-starter for them. But people deserve to have the economic security to get them through this pandemic. And we're doing this as quickly as possible because we understand that this is an emergency and it's a health emergency and it's an economic emergency.
Well, on this health emergency, so we've got President-elect Biden coming into office next month. What do you see as the actions that he and the new Congress are going to be likely to take to address COVID in those first 100 days? What can we expect in terms of action out of Congress and the Biden administration?
Well, I think he has laid it out, and I'm really pleased that he has put, quote, crushing this virus as a top priority. He has said he's going to ask for everyone to wear masks for 100 days. He's going to come up with a system, a distribution system for the vaccine. And we're going to have to come up with a major stimulus plan. Remember, ours was over $3 trillion, now whittled down to 900 and some billion. And so we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and come up with a real economic recovery plan that includes the health provisions, as well as provisions for economic stability and recovery and job creation. Because remember, so many people lost their jobs, which will not return. And so we're going to have resources in for job training and retraining. And I'm confident that in the first 100 days, the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, will live up to what they have committed to living up to. And that's crushing this virus and addressing the lives and livelihood of people who have been so afflicted by this pandemic.
Well, and you mentioned the vaccine. So what would you like to see the Biden administration do to ensure that it's widely and equitably distributed? What steps would you hope that that Biden administration and maybe Congress too might take?
Well, what first thing is we have to make sure the resources are there to purchase the quantity of vaccines that are needed for our vulnerable populations, essential workers, for all of the top priority populations that have been designated, but also moving forward so that we can have at least 70 to 80% of the population vaccinated. And so the first thing we're going to have to do, and we had in our bill resources in the first and second HEROES Act funding for the purchase of vaccines. So we're going to have to do that. And then secondly, we have to help set up a distribution system, help the states do that. Right now, some states are moving forward because they have the resources. Others just don't have the money to set up a distribution system. So we're going to have to be partners with the state in terms of finding the actual resources and the methodology and the systems that need to be established for vaccinations, because evidently we're going to have a heck of a lot more than what has already been ordered by the Trump administration.
Well, and a lot of people have expressed skepticism about taking the vaccine. What do you say to people who might be reluctant to be a quote guinea pig on the vaccine?
Well, I say I see you and I hear you, especially if you're an African American or a person of color, because we are very skeptical because of in many, many issues, the Tuskegee study where we were used as guinea pigs and, you know, experimental treatments. We haven't been included in a lot of the clinical trials. Medically underserved communities, even where there are healthcare systems in place, access has been denied and people of color have been mistreated. I remember stories just recently of African Americans showing up at the emergency room with COVID, and they were sent home and they died. They weren't even treated in a way that most people should be, that everyone should be treated when you come to an emergency room, when you go to an emergency room. So there's enough skepticism in our healthcare system because of historical systemic racism that I understand that. But having said that, we're going to have trusted messengers. And I'm glad the former presidents are going to be vaccinated in public. We're going to have people who our communities believe in and trust be the public health messengers. I have a bill, the COVID Community Care Act, which would provide resources for nonprofits, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations to provide the testing, contact tracing, treatment, and referrals for isolation. But it also would provide resources to train trusted messengers in the community to deliver the public health messages, because we have to have people who are multilingual, who are linguistically appropriate for a specific community, who can speak the language, who understands the culture and the skepticism, and have to be able to have people who can deliver these public health messages. Otherwise, people will not believe their government once again. And we have to understand there are plenty of reasons that people do not believe that the government is going to be on their side once again. So it's up to us to find the resources to be able to convince them and to deliver the messages by trusted messengers that we are on their side this time.
Well, we'll look to see how that legislation fares in the new Congress, but it certainly sounds like a sensible approach to encouraging people to take the vaccine once it's available. I wanted to ask you.
Well,
go ahead.
Let me just make one point, because in the HEROES bill, which the Republicans would not support, we put in quite a bit of this language which I just described, with the resources to do just that. And so this is, if we could get this in this bill, it's not waiting until next year. We could have had it in 3 months ago, 4 months ago. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry.
No. I appreciate that extra information about it. And I wanted to ask you about the stay-at-home orders that we've seen, you know, particularly in your district, across California, really across the United States, in response to this sort of third, you know, surge upon surge that we're seeing with COVID. A lot of people are getting really frustrated about having to kind of go backwards and shut some things down, particularly restaurant owners, parents who can't now access playgrounds for their kids. So what role do you think elected leaders like yourself can take to sort of encourage and inspire constituents to try to comply, particularly when there's been so much frustration and, frankly, seeing politicians not following their own guidelines, like we've seen with some of the headlines around the governor's visit to French Laundry restaurant?
Well, everyone has COVID fatigue, so I can understand that. But this is a matter of life and death. And I do, just in terms of myself, public health messages. I talk to constituents. I try to put forth information through social media and through the media with regard to what will help crush this virus. And I'm telling you, the stay-at-home orders, wearing masks, washing one's hands, using hand sanitizer, staying 6 feet apart. We know from the scientists and our medical experts that that works. So whatever works, remember, we've had over 270,000 people die. And so we have got to understand that I am my brother's keeper. I am my sister's keeper. We have to look out for each other and whatever it takes. And that's why it's so important we, at the federal level, have those resources so that people don't lose their jobs, so businesses don't go under, and so people can survive until they can thrive once again. But we have to follow the health protocols, because otherwise this time next year we'll be in the same place. And so with the vaccine coming, with knowing what to do that will help help turn this curve and bring it down, we know what it takes. And so I'm just asking everyone to understand that and to please listen to the healthcare directives and try to, and it's hard to say sacrifice, because everyone has been sacrificing so much for so long now, but I see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm just hoping that people will understand why these requirements are needed, recognizing that there are ways to hopefully, you know, be with friends and family as long as we have the proper health directives and protocols in place.
Let me switch gears and ask you about a different subject, and this is about anti-racism efforts. I know that you've got some legislation that you've introduced around a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but I'm just wondering what you see as sort of likely to happen in this next Congress around anti-racism efforts, and what you would sort of expect to have happen legislatively on that.
Sure. Well, Senator Warren and I have a bill called Anti-Racism in the Public Health Act, because systemic racism is so embedded in our public health systems. Until we want to address public health within the context of systemic racism for low-income people, for Black and brown people. So that's one bill that is extremely important that we're building support for. Also, I have HR 100, which is calling for a U.S. Commission on Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation. We've never had, especially in the African-American community, a truth-telling moment in this country that sets forth what took place 401 years ago and how it still is manifested today in systemic racism. And I'm talking about the Middle Passage and slavery, 200 and some years of enslaved Africans in America, which was a horrible, horrific period. The legacy of that period, you can see today with regard to mass incarceration, the disproportionate numbers of African-Americans who are in jail for drug offenses, disproportionate number of African-Americans, Black and brown people who have died from COVID, the wage gap, all of this. Most countries, there are over 40 countries that have established these commissions after genocides, after crimes against humanity, after slavery. The United States never has done this. And so we have to have this day of reckoning, this truth-telling moment, because if we can't be honest about how we got to where we are and why we are where we are, we'll never be able to heal and move forward. And so that's a bill that I've got probably about 185 co-sponsors of. The Democratic Party and its platform endorsed it. Also, we've got to look at repairing the damage and what that means. California passed a reparations bill, and that is so important for us to do at the federal level, HR 40, because you've got to repair the damage of the past. The descendants of enslaved Africans are still economically at the bottom of the totem pole. They're still dealing with the systemic racism that's embedded and in the DNA of every system in our country. So this is a big issue on racial justice we've got to address. Also, we've got to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. When you look at the murders of Black and brown people in this country by the police, we have to have police reform. We have to have restructuring of our criminal justice system. And so we must pass this, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act next Congress. And of course, the Moore Act, which I was really proud to be part of getting off the floor, which really deschedules cannabis from the list of controlled substances, which means we can move forward now and begin to dismantle the war on drugs. You know, 80% of the prison population in prison for drug offenses are African Americans or Latinx. And so we've got to provide, and that bill provides for the expungement of records, a restorative justice fund to help people who were convicted of these crimes by these unjust laws, help them get their lives back together and move on. And finally, as a racial justice issue, we've got to have justice and equity in the industry. Because the cannabis industry in California and other states that have passed these laws is a booming industry in terms of economic growth and job creation. Right now, less than 4% of the licenses are granted to African Americans and people of color. So we've got to have a racial justice, racial equity lens that is embedded in all of our policies around cannabis and marijuana reform. So there are many, many efforts around racial justice that we have to embark upon and get past, because enough is enough. And I think our young people, and I'm so proud of our Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for Black lives, our dreamers, our young people have said enough is enough and we can't go back. And so we've got to begin to dismantle systemic racism.
Well, and a lot of these issues you raised are really a core part of the progressive agenda and will require, you know, votes in Congress. And, you know, on that score, we've got, you know, results from November. We've also got an important Senate runoff coming up. You know, in the November election, Democrats, as you're well aware, you know, lost seats in the House. I think generally from a sort of legislative state House perspective, didn't do as well as expected, lost some ground. And I'm wondering what you make of those setbacks in Congress for in the November election and what that might mean for this January Senate runoff election in Georgia, which will determine or could determine control of the Senate.
Well, certainly we didn't win all of our House seats, but let me tell you, it's because Donald Trump his voters turned out. They voted en masse. And so in many of these districts, they outvoted Democrats. But we won. We still are in the majority in the House. We still will have, I think, 130 some committee or subcommittee chairs. And we're moving forward with the Biden-Harris agenda to begin to, as the Biden slogan is, build back better. I think it's important to get engaged for those who are listening with the Georgia races. There are plenty of activities going on, voter education, fundraising, texting, phone banking from California that we can do. We need to have a partner in the Senate, or at least a Senate that's a partner with the Biden-Harris administration. And the two Senate seats in Georgia are absolutely necessary for that.
Is there anything you would have liked to have seen Democrats do differently to have blunted the impact of the Trump turnout? Do you think that mistakes were made in terms of messaging or any other strategy around the Democratic congressional races?
Well, we're looking at each race, race by race, district by district. But I can tell you what we've learned is that the Republicans have taken messaging to another level, where they have just outright lied and really put out messages that Democrats never even talked about, never even mentioned. But they knew how to package the attack ads in a way that in many ways we did not do. And so they attacked with lies that were blatant lies. And you can see that in many of these races. So we're in the process of analyzing what took place, but we do have the House, and we have a majority, and we're moving forward with our agenda, which is an agenda for the people to make sure that we crush this virus and make sure that people's lives and livelihoods are put back in shape so that they can move forward and live the type of life that they deserve to live as Americans.
Well, and my last question for you is just, you know, of all of the issues we've covered in this discussion just now, you know, what else would you see as possibly happening in those first 100 days? You know, that's typically when you see the most, you know, congressional action with a new president coming in. And I'm just wondering what you would see as sort of the issues that people should be expecting some action on.
Well, I tell you that right now, looking at where we are, it's going to be the coronavirus, attacking the coronavirus. That's going to take up a heck of a lot. Of course, we've got to put forth a climate bill, which is going to be extremely important. But I think right now, when the Biden-Harris administration takes over, making sure we have an economic recovery plan, a stimulus plan that's going to put people back to work, and that's going to make sure that our businesses, and especially our small and minority businesses, are able to come back into business if they were shut down, and move forward and employ people and create jobs like they do in such a way that we couldn't survive without our small businesses. So I think that's it. The health agenda and the economic agenda in the first 100 days is going to be a very aggressive agenda, and we've got to look at it in terms of saving lives and livelihoods. And that's the first 100 days.
All right. Well, I know I said that was my last question for you, but I'd be remiss if I didn't also ask about the Senate seat that's going to be open now with Kamala Harris becoming the vice president. Your name has been mentioned as a potential candidate for the governor to appoint to this seat. Have you talked to the governor about it? Are you interested in the seat?
Well, I tell you, if the governor called me and indicated he would have wanted to appoint me, I would certainly say yes, and I'm honored to be on the list.
Great. Well, we really appreciate that you've come on the show to talk to us. We wish you best of luck with the new Congress, and thank you so much for your service to your constituents here in the Bay Area, Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Thanks so much.
Thank you again. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Congresswoman Lee. Appreciate that.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.